Hello. Today we have the good fortune of having Steve Olszewski with us. Steve has been a longtime friend at Radnor Meeting, and he has also had a successful 40-year career in information management. He's done many things with Quaker organizations, and its service includes being, in fact, starting Radnor Meeting's Climate Action Committee, serving on Philadelphia Yearly's meetings. Eco Justice Collaborative and the Quaker Earth Care Witness. He has also served as treasurer of Friends Committee of National Legislation. After 40 years, he did retire from his career and relocated to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, where he is currently chair of Bethlehem's Environmental Advisory Council. When not advocating for our environment, he hangs out with his four grandsons and plays as much tennis as possible. And today we are going to talk about his activities over many years and what the Quaker values of empathy and mindfulness, ecological integrity, right action or resilience, growth, and endurance may have motivated any part of his actions, and which are definitely spirit-led. So, Steve, welcome. It's good to have you with us today.
Welcome, Bert. Thanks for that great introduction. I really appreciate that. It's great to be here. We've got a lovely weather here in Bethlehem. It's a good day to have this conversation.
It's like an active springtime after some very cold times and a heat wave, and now we're settling into what we like about where we live. And
Exactly.
I'm fascinated by the different roles that you have played during your time working with different Quaker organizations and how you move the skills that you have acquired and honed during your career managing information technical projects. And transferred that skill to be useful to what could be an amorphous situation of addressing climate change. And you got real traction with that. Could you talk about that a little?
Yeah, sure. I think one of the things that helped me is in my career with information technology, it becomes clear as you start to understand the different parts of technology. So there's or information technology. So there's infrastructure involved, there's people involved, there's big things like data centers involved, and it takes quite an understanding of systems, I'll call it, how all these fit together to make something work, like information technology, and to provide services like the internet or customer service and billing applications for a major corporation, things like that. So, understanding how all the pieces fit together and a systems approach to life, if you will, really helps you understand how our planet works and some of the things we need to do to maintain our planet and keep it sustainable. So you start thinking about the world in terms of causes and effects and impacts, and how little things on one side of the world can impact things on the other side of the world, and how it all fits together. And once you have that more comprehensive understanding, you can take more care and attention at making sure our world stays safe for our kids and our kids' kids as we go forward.
That really seems to fit well into the merged value of mindfulness, that you are mindful of the coherence of how everything works together.
Yeah, that's a good point. It really, in my experience, it really takes a curiosity kind of as you live in this world, trying to understand how all the world works. And some of, as you grow up and you start living in the world, some of what you experience is based on assumptions. So, for example, when I was younger, I always assumed that the people before me, my ancestors, had thought things through and thought the impacts of their actions and what they do. In many cases, that's true because our ancestors have good intentions for making things happen. But sometimes there are things that happen that haven't been thought through, and really understanding and having a curiosity to explore those things a little bit more, and then having to be called, I'll call it, into right action to correct those things, correct those assumptions that we've had for a long time about what we need to do and how we need to take care of the planet, and share what that revelation is with others to help them and educate them and help us all work together to maintain this beautiful planet that we live on.
Yeah, it seems that after, along with mindfulness, which is an ongoing thought also, and it's mindful, which is a thought process, it's also a spiritual process, and taking your Quaker values to that and making your evaluations and your discernments based on a spiritual approach to the situation, and realizing that a lot of things were not thought out, especially towards the end stage of it, and who it is that is affected by that, by taking also the value of empathy to seeing where things have not been thought out, and that there are people, many people in the world who are not prospering, who are suffering as a result of lack of mindfulness on the part of many people.
That's right. That's a good point, Bert. To really live in this world, you need to have that empathy and really think about how your actions impact others. Some of our actions here in the United States may not impact our local community. They might impact the community on the other side of the world. And understanding what that impact looks like for them helps build empathy and helps call you into action to recognize that, hey, there might be some injustice in what I'm doing here because it's unfairly impacting somebody in the Southern Hemisphere. And what would it feel like for us if they were doing that to us? How would we feel about that? And then feeling like it's unjust and wanting to have some empathy for them calls you into action.
Yes, that is very important with that, especially when you can see what is happening and there are others who act as though they don't know. I like that the title of the Quaker organization, Eco Justice, that strives to work on just that kind of empathy, the basis.
Make it fair for everybody.
Yes, make it
Right.
fair for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And for Earth Care Witness, that name right there is about mindfulness as being a witness to what we see. And I was wondering about the part that you played in that.
So I was just beginning my awareness of all of the environmental and sustainability issues. So I became part of Quaker Earth Care Witness just to find out more. So it was that curiosity again. I wanted to find out what some of my Quaker friends had been doing in that area, and especially Quakers outside of the Philadelphia area, because I've been very familiar with what we've been doing at PYM. So Quaker Earth Care Witness was a way to get familiar with what friends are doing, for example, in California and Colorado and Washington State, things like that, and help us all join together, learn what we have been working on, and support each other in pursuing work in our local communities to help make some change that we thought was needed. I thought it was a really great organization. It's a wealth of knowledge that they've accumulated over time. So it was a great place for me to start my education and make connections with other people that had already done a lot of work in this area.
It must have spurred another E, which is endurance. I mean, you've been doing
I'm
this.
laughing because, yes, endurance is key here. People don't like change, and our world is a world built for our convenience. Humans are good at making things more convenient for us, and understanding the cost of that convenience is important. My discovery is that trying to educate people into doing something different and convincing them or enrolling them in a need for change isn't that easy, and it requires a lot of endurance.
Yes, and you have had shifting roles in that, and it's inter what's interesting to me as you've served in different capacities. For instance, where you had been treasurer of France Committee on National Legislation, which is not directly on the ramparts of the work in climate change, and yet is an important function in supporting the work that does.
Yeah, does a great job in many areas. Certainly, peace and justice in the world is at the forefront, and how it was, and one of the reasons why it was founded. But it's taken on the role of earth care as well, and making sure that the actions that our government takes are for the right reasons, for long-term environmental sustainability. It's FCNL is the oldest faith-based lobbying organization in Washington, and it's really important to have that. Our political leaders need to know where we as Quakers stand on things, and that organization does some great work in convincing our political leaders in the need for action in certain areas in the environment, as well as maintaining peace in the world and having equal justice throughout.
Well, our environment, our culture, our society, humankind is based on the ability to live on the planet and for the planet to provide us with our input of
Yeah.
what we need to live, to support our families. And as climate change, as global warming is taking its effect, many of those resources are diminishing. They're being badly damaged and sometimes at the most marginal of survival areas. And as that happens, basically it's disturbing the peace. And that is a very bland term for what the conflicts that are going on there and the suffering that is caused, not only directly, but indirectly, as people need to migrate to places where the environment is still adequate for supporting them.
That's an excellent point, Bert. So one of the things that I learned in my education was that our military is tasked with making assessments on risk. What are the risks that our country has that the military needs to prepare for? And in doing this assessment, one of the major risks that they've identified is the climate change issue. And just as you said, as climate impacts certain areas of the world worse, more than others, it will cause migrations of people from one area of the world to others, and scarcity for resources like food and fresh water and things like that, which could end up destabilizing the world order. So our military has already identified this as a threat to the extent where they're making plans to how do we deal with that. So I don't know what else to say about that other than there are many parts of our government which have agreed that this is a problem. There are some parts of our federal government which tend to ignore it and want to sweep it under the rug. That's a very frustrating thing for me and all of us working in environment and sustainability now. But like we talked about earlier, endurance is one of the key things you need right now, endurance and resilience in working through all of this.
Yes, it makes us wish, as we have heard any number of times in the past decades, that we had a Department of Peace as much as we have a Department of War, or Defense, as it's called, but that it has clearly identified that global warming is a real challenge to the stability of our life here in the world, and that it will cause all these disturbances. And but I don't know if it's thinking through what can we do best to check it. And that is one to what you were started there here at Radnor Meeting is the Climate Action Committee. And I think it is a wonderful action because it brings it local also. Because if we're talking about the globe and this monster of a War Department that we have, it's important to be able to find what is local with our community that we can do.
Yeah, exactly. And what I'm finding is there's a lot that can be done in the local community. One of the things that I've discovered, so on my sustainability resume that we've covered a lot of so far, you see a lot of it was in the Quaker world and learning from friends that have done this work previously. But one of the things I also learned is all of that information that I learned and the style of working through change that is the Quaker process really is valuable out there in the world. And one of the things that I discovered is taking that out into the secular world is a really important thing, and the world needs that. So one of the things that I'm involved with now, as you mentioned earlier, is the Environmental Advisory Council. So that is a council that's supported, that is created and set up by our city council. So all the members on it are appointed volunteers. And what I've discovered is there's a lot of what we are trained in as Quakers in the Quaker process and everything is very helpful in municipal government. So you do have to have patience and you have to understand the process of making changes in the municipal government. So, for example, one of the things we're working on now is an ordinance to try to ban the use of styrofoam in the food industry. So, no more styrofoam containers for takeout or for serving, things like that, because really feeling like styrofoam is bad for the environment in that it's typically ends up in a landfill and it doesn't degrade for a couple hundred years. And the chemicals that styrofoam's made out of are harmful to human health. So for all those things, for all those reasons, we're trying to find a way to get it out of our environment so it doesn't end up in a landfill and doesn't have an impact on human health. But developing that ordinance and getting everybody to buy in and sign off on it takes a lot of effort to educate people and to work through them, come at them. They are in the world now. What are their thoughts on styrofoam? What is their knowledge about its good points and bad points? And any beneficial use that it might have, and then also sharing with people the negative sides of using it and understanding all of that. And working through that, I'm finding takes a fair amount of work. We're working through at a committee level now, the waste, we call it the Waste Reduction Committee, having to understand how big the problem is with styrofoam, what some of the legal issues are that we need to take care of if we want to put in place an ordinance to ban it, making connections with city government to understand people in city government that need to have a knowledge of what we're trying to do, the extent of it, the legality of it, things like that. All takes time. We started this work probably about 4 or 5 months ago, and we're still at the point now where we're about to review the ordinance for, I think, the third time. and get people's buy-in. And every time we review it, more questions come up and some issues come up that we need to take care of to make sure it ends up being a legal document and things like that. So all of those skills that I learned in the Quaker organizations that we mentioned earlier are really helping me in the secular world to help make an impact in a right way for our environment and sustainability.
Yeah, it's as you are addressing a problem at a specific level. If you take the product stream from where it is first created out of a oil, a fossil fuel, through where it's manufactured and then made into products that we find useful for our day-to-day life, and then where it is, say, single use or even more than single use, but it's still discarded at the end of a useful life, and then it goes into the waste stream where it is often toxic to either a landfill or if it's dumped into a water someplace, it ends up with our oceans are polluted. There is plastic everywhere. There's styrofoam being a big part of it. So it's very interesting that you are working intensively on that phase of it. That has its big effect further upstream in the manufacturer and by not creating a demand, and then further downstream by not creating the pollution that would result.
And a lot of it is just education. So, for example, a friend and I went out to lunch at a local restaurant and we sat down. We had a great conversation. At the end, we had some leftovers. So, we asked for some takeout containers. And the assistant manager of the restaurant brought us styrofoam clamshells to put our leftovers in. And I was a little surprised because I had heard that restaurants were doing this, but I thought a lot of them had gotten away from that. But he brought the clamshells out for us to put our takeaway food in. And then we started a conversation with the assistant manager and we said, "Hey, are you aware that these things are made out of styrofoam? And are you aware of the impact that it has on our environment? It can break up into little pieces. Animals can start thinking the little pieces of this white stuff are food, so they'll ingest it and they'll end up having severe problems as a result of that." We talked about the impact of human health. So if you put hot or acidic food in styrofoam, the chemicals that make styrofoam can leach out into the food and then you ingest it. So we started sharing all of this in a conversation. The assistant manager had no idea. He was just picking things off of a list that his wholesaler was sending him, things that you can put takeaway food in. And he thought, "Oh, all this stuff is safe to use. I have no concerns here. We'll just pick the cheapest thing." But again, going back to assumptions we make, we just assume things people are offering us for sale are safe for us. And it turns out, if you look into it a little bit deeper, if you have that curiosity saying, "Hey, what's going on here?" you find out things aren't as you may have assumed they were. So we're now starting or developing a plan to do some education with the city. How can we do the education to help inform people that, hey, some of the stuff that you may be using with your customers may not be safe for your customers and start looking at alternatives that are safer.
Is there any anticipation that you will be addressing that among, say, larger companies? Let's talk about food chains, restaurant services that might be moving away from styrofoam cups and things like that in their business practices. Other communities may be presenting the same issues to them and that they are already thinking of what they can do that would be a better practice than what they are doing now.
Yeah, you're right. A lot of companies have already started doing this. So, what we're doing in Bethlehem is by no means on the cutting edge. Other places have done this already. New York, the state of New Jersey has done it. I think California's done it already. The whole country of India has banned styrofoam in addition to single-use plastics.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, there's 1.2 billion people that are getting by without styrofoam and single-use plastics. We're by no means on the cutting edge here in Bethlehem, but companies like McDonald's have already given it up. If you remember many years ago, if
Oh,
you
yes.
ordered a quarter pounder, you got it in a styrofoam clamshell. McDonald's stopped doing that as a result of this work in other areas. And we've already agreed that for our local community, for restaurants like the one that I stopped in, part of putting this ordinance in place really needs to be an education campaign to help people understand why we want to ban it. And we think we have some really good reasons for doing that. And my assumption is that by educating people alone, a lot of people will switch just because they're not aware.
They'll ask for the product that they want to have, that they prefer to have, rather than whatever a company might be dishing out. And it's a virtual circle, virtuous circle, that it becomes better the further along in the process we are. And it is a large use of fossil fuels that we know is a major cause of the temperature rising. And but we don't see the connections from what we do to that, and therefore we're not as empowered to make changes as if we knew, when we do know.
And seeing those connections all goes back to the mindfulness in Emerge, right?
Yes.
Being aware of it, really taking some time to think through how the system, how it all works, the cause and effect and the impact and things like that.
Yeah, to be sure, we think of the biggest chunk of the problem is about the vehicles burning gasoline that we're not using. We're driving all of our electricity, or so much of our electricity, from fossil fuels of coal, gas, petroleum products. But this is something that it's definitely touches on our lives, and we can make changes in that. I read that there is an article, read an article about Al Gore, that in this week's Times, New York Times, that he is rebuilding his slideshow, An Inconvenient Truth, that has made such a big impact and was recognized with an Academy Award, and he's changing it to the extent that the first was highly focused on moral values of what we have to do because of the moral initiative to it. And as he is looking at it now, he's bringing a lot of these day-to-day changes where the economic factors are shifting mightily in the direction of renewable resources. The cost of generating electricity is being reduced, is less costly using solar panels or wind turbines. And I am certain that the changes that you are looking at in the product stream, making the adjustments there, will bring costs down. It's not locked in the way many people might assume.
I'm glad you brought up Al Gore because I've been thinking a lot about him lately.
Oh, okay.
So the big thing for Al Gore was his presentation on An Inconvenient Truth. And I remember when I first watched the movie, I was left with a feeling like, yes, it's inconvenient that all these fossil fuel industries are burning coal and gas and they're making a profit. And as a result, they are heating up the world, and we need to stop these fossil fuel companies from doing this. The more I've been thinking about it lately, the more I'm thinking Al Gore's title, Inconvenient Truth, was somewhat of a genius move on his part. Because the more I think about it, it's less about big oil or big coal, if you will, burning things. It's more about convenience and actually our personal convenience. So all of these things are happening because it's convenient for us.
Yes.
It's convenient for us to take home food home in a really cheap styrofoam container. It's cheap for us to burn oil. It's cheap for us to burn coal, all for our personal convenience. So you talked about Al Gore shifting towards more of a moral calling for some of this. I'm glad to hear that because I think that's what's needed. I think we all need to contemplate every day what things are we doing for our own convenience that are causing the problems we see in the world.
I agree. And there are changes that we can make that are individual and relatively small. And then there are changes that we need to make that are larger and that we need to look at our community, however that is defined. What changes that we may have been looking at the Radnor meeting community, changing how we produce heat for the winter time from gas burners to heat pumps. For instance, and in a number of changes like that, or how you are working at the municipal level there to make changes.
Let's talk about the example with Radnor Meeting for a minute, because I
Sure.
think that's a great example. As we had an effort to try to get the meeting to convert from gas heating to using heat pumps. And by using heat pumps, they'd be using electricity, and you can subscribe in Pennsylvania for all renewable electricity. So therefore, the greenhouse gas impact from heating the meeting house would go away. But it seemed like there were a fair number of people in the meeting that thought it would be inconvenient to walk into the meeting house on a winter's day where the temperature wasn't 72 degrees. And there's a feeling, and I think this is an assumption, there's a feeling that heat pumps couldn't maintain the heat inside the meeting house, so people would be inconvenienced. They might need to wear a coat during meeting in the middle of January if it was really cold out. So for all of that, Radnor Meeting kept producing greenhouse gases, and to this day is still producing greenhouse gases, I think, in the
Well,
meeting house.
at the meeting house, it was changed
Oh, good.
to heat pumps. However, the details of that is that we looked at the electric supply that was coming in, and one of those who was bidding on it said that we don't have enough electric power coming in to maintain during the coldest of days. And so we developed a hybrid system where it was a heat pump that had a gas backup so that if a temperature ever got so low that the electric power supplied was inadequate, it would turn on the gas and the gas would be there. It was had been there before, and which is a workaround solution that is fine because of the way that it's installed. It would have been very expensive to increase the amount of electricity that PECO would be bringing into our building. It was a structural element. It was underground, it was through the walls, a lot of things. It would have been very time-consuming and costly. So we did that, and we now hear that there are even more equipment that can monitor moment by moment the occupancy and the temperature, and make the adjustment to optimize the efficiency of how the electricity is used, which brings down the cost of using it, which is important if anyone, including friends, are thinking about it. But one of the big things that we had to deal with is just the fear that it might not provide what the conveniences that we have become accustomed to.
Yeah, so for want of convenience, the meeting's going to emit greenhouse gases on days where it's really cold.
Some amount, yes. And that was a way that we found to maintain unity in the community there, which.
And I don't want to get into blame or anything for Radnor Meeting. It's just an interesting story, I think, about the need of humans to feel convenience. and
Yes.
what they're willing to do for that convenience.
I agree. And as I look at drawings, etchings, whatever, of Quaker meetings from back in the day, from the 1700s and so on, and they're all warmly dressed. That they had more or less cold spells and warm spells, but the cold spells were really warm. And they were just heating it with a wood burning stove, one wood burning stove in the middle of the room. The other room also had a wood burning stove in the middle of it, and that was fine. However, we have become accustomed to the convenience of comfort as we
Yeah,
tend to
and I'm guilty of that too. So, for example, I have a car. I'm in need of a car for transportation here, especially if I want to see my grandson once a week. I unfortunately need that convenience to be able to have a car pick him up from school and drive him to and from his home and things like that. I could have chosen to buy a fully electric car. I didn't. Instead, I bought a plug-in hybrid because here in Bethlehem, there at the time I bought the car, there weren't many places to plug it in to recharge it. So to if I would have bought a fully electric car to reduce my greenhouse gases for transportation, it would have been really inconvenient for me to find a place to charge that car once a week when I needed to do so. So I opted not to do that. I feel a little guilty about that, but I did it, and I'm trying in other areas of my life to reduce my greenhouse gas emissions in other ways.
It's interesting what you say about that, that it is the cheapest way for the mileage if you can charge your car off of your own electric meter. However, if you're going out to a commercial recharging station, it tends to be even more expensive than gasoline. And however, it is just a step along the way towards acceptance of the fact that this is not just something that those who may have are well off and want not to be using fossil fuels. One of those things that we recognize with that is that the state of Pennsylvania is now, I think it's called a RUF, a road utility usage fee, that basically they are charging a fee for all electric vehicles and plug-in hybrids, because they expect they will, and they've probably seen it, a drop in the usage that I think it's about 10 cents a gallon they get from the sale of gasoline for their road work. And the roads need to be paid. The road work needs to be done. So this is a way that they're finding it. And I also have a plug-in hybrid that I am not using, plugging it in lately. But I'm paying for that fee anyway. I'm not quite sure how they determine what that is, but there are so many different steps along the way towards a world that we are want to move towards.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to agree with you. Yeah.
So we are so grateful for the work that you continue to do. Her endurance is remarkable, that you are doing up there in Bethlehem, and that I can see is deepening our experience with taking it from just a values-based issue into as you were saying, out into the secular world where it can make an even larger difference. This is one of the things they say about Quakers being an influential group of people, by living our values and bringing that out in the world.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's important for us. I think us Quakers have a lot to bring out into, I'll call it the secular world. A lot of our attitudes about peace, justice, love, and understanding of everyone, everywhere can help us in bridging the divides that we have, as well as enrolling people in the need for change from a justice perspective.
I think that's wonderful. I think that's the road that we are all traveling on as Quakers, and I think it's important. Anyway,
Good.
Steve, if you have any other thoughts before we say goodbye.
One other thing that I wanted to mention in terms of trying to people in right action. So I was lucky enough, the work that I had done earlier in other Quaker organizations, to come in contact with Ed Drebe.
Oh,
Ed
yes.
Drebe's been a real mentor and an inspiration for me and all the work that he's done. It was some of his work that actually got FCNL to address climate change as an important issue. So I was lucky enough to be under his tutelage for a little bit, and he helped me understand things like Spaceship Earth, which I think you've touched on other podcasts here, things like that have really helped me. One of the things that I've been thinking a lot about lately is this idea of the commons. So one of the things that came out of all the work that he had done before is this idea that there are things in this world that are common to all of us that sustain us from a living perspective, our air, our water, our things like that we all share. And one of the things that I think will help enroll people in making a change is that through capitalism, now I'm not an anti-capitalist. I think capitalism has done a lot for many people and raised a lot of the world's population out of poverty and helped them a lot. But one of the things that I think is a challenge for capitalism is the assumption that the commons, our air and our water and the land that we share, is to be used for anybody for any use whatsoever, as opposed to thinking that the commons need to be shared by everybody and we need to share them in a sustainable way. So, for example, here's a story that I heard that fits in, that's kind of an analogy for the use of capitalism in the modern day. So, I have a neighbor that decided to be an entrepreneur and start a recycling business. So he started accepting all this stuff from the neighbors in his community, and he started accepting cardboard for recycling and newspaper recycling and plastic and glass and aluminum. And he found that he could accept all of this stuff, and he was able to find other companies that would buy most of the stuff from him. So they would buy the cardboard and he made some money off of that, and they'd buy the newspapers for recycling and he made some money off of that. But he discovered that he had no use for the glass that came to him from the community. So he's trying to figure out what he could do with the glass. So he looked into it and he discovered that he could pay somebody to take the glass away and dump it in a landfill. But if he paid that amount, he wouldn't have a profit anymore. So, in order to maintain his profit, he decided to start dumping the glass that he had gotten that accumulated over the fence to his next door neighbor. He's thinking, that's an easy way to get rid of the glass and I don't have to pay anybody for it. Needless to say, the neighbor got awfully upset because now the glass that was thrown away was now his problem and impacting him, while his neighbor that had started the recycling business was making a nice profit over the stuff he could sell and discarding the things that he couldn't resell and recycle. So that story is just an analogy for the way some of our companies in the world think about our commons. They think that they can produce a product or something like that and dump the waste that results from that into a creek or a river or into a landfill or something like that, and assume that it's not a problem for anybody, where those neighbors surrounding that lake or that river or landfill, for them, it is a problem. So it doesn't seem fair that some private companies get to take advantage of our commons like that. So one of the things the environmental movement is trying to do is to put a price on that and say, if you're going to use that, you need to pay for the impact you have to the commons. And I think that's an important thing for people to see that how our commons are getting impacted and that we shouldn't just allow people to do that without having to pay a price for that so that we can maintain that and clean it up afterwards or prevent it happening from the beginning and put in the technology that prevents that kind of damage. So I just wanted to share that kind of thinking as a way for thinking, oh, starting up a coal plant, that doesn't do anything. It just puts smoke into the air and it doesn't bother anybody. When in fact, it's damaging our common, the air that we have and we all breathe. And it is putting bad stuff into the air, like mercury and other things like that, sulfur, things like that. So I just wanted to share that in hopes that people would see the bigger picture and see how the world is working and how our commons are being impacted and think about ways to correct.
That is such an important basis for basically everything that we are doing, and how, in a way, we've gone wrong by not recognizing our ownership of the commons, and our sense, our ability to control it has been diminished, that we've been pushed into little boxes here and there and whatever, and not realizing that all of that is owned by all of us jointly. That's part of our property. Our
And
responsibility.
it's not fair or just for a private individual or private corporation to be able to profit from the exploitation of the commons.
Yes, absolutely. And any usage of the commons should be equitably priced. Any cleanup that might need to be done needs to go back to those that despoiled it.
I just wanted to leave our conversation on that note and give people something to think about and be mindful about and generate some empathy about, all tying us back to our Emerge conversation that we started with.
Yes, and looking for right action to address all of these, to know
Exactly.
that this is what we need to do. Steve, it has been wonderful to be talking with you this morning and this beautiful spring day. And I hope that you were grateful. And I hope you have a good time if you are playing tennis or visiting your grandsons or whatever you might be doing today.
All right, thanks, Bert. It's been great catching up with you and talking with you about all this. And let's keep our endurance going. All
All right. Thank you, Steve.
right, have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.